Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Like, why do we eat some roots of some plants and some tops of some other plants and vice versa?
That's Chef Sean Pham. His restaurant is Simbal in Little Tokyo. I caught up with him at the Hollywood Farmers Market last weekend.
For instance, if we go walk down here, you'll see carrots and you'll see carrot tops littered on the floor. No one wants them. And then you go down to cilantro and you see cilantro, then you wonder, where are the roots for the cilantro?
I'm really happy to hear you're using the root because cilantro is a plant that goes to seed so quickly. Anybody who's ever tried to grow it at home knows that it's just like, it's there and then it's gone. So it's great really to know what to do with the root. What does it look like and does it taste stronger than the leaves?
The cilantro root looks like, I would say, little fingers almost, but they have short little stems sticking out, and it's primarily used in Thai cooking.
What do you do with it?
It's primarily used for curry paste. And with Thai cooking, they use a lot of pungent things such as shrimp paste or fish sauce, and it adds an herbaceousness to bring the funkiness back down to a palatable level.
So Sean, when you buy it, does it come just separate, like a little bunch of little stubby roots, or is it still attached to the leaves?
Here, you're going to find it attached just because there's no demand for the cilantro roots themselves. So the farmers are going to sell you the whole plant.
And then when you get it, do you just grind it all up together or do you divide them up?
So we're going to cut off the cilantro roots from the stems and the tops. We're going to wash the cilantro roots very well. And then we're going to place them in a mortar and pestle and pound them to make a paste.
What kind of pestle do you use? Do you use a stone one or a wood one?
We use a stone one, definitely. When you're making a paste, especially with hard ingredients such as cilantro root or galangal, and you're really going to have to get in there and pound hard, stone makes your life a lot easier.
In this case, what kind of curry paste are you making, and then what is the main ingredient?
Sure. So this dish is actually not a curry, but it's actually a marinade for a meat dish. The dish is called Heavenly Beef. And the old recipe for this is that the beef is marinated in a marinade of palm sugar, fish sauce, coriander seeds, garlic, and cilantro roots. And the recipe says to leave it on the roof of your house for 2 days after you marinate it. And this is Thailand, mind you. So it's 100 degrees, very humid. Basically, you're lightly rotting the meat. But the Thai people really value the funkiness, the sour things that come off of something like that. So what we do is we get dried beef fat, we render it down, and then at the very end of the cooking process, we add a little bit of dried beef fat to add another layer of funkiness without putting on the roof of our restaurant.
So even though I know we're not going to find dried beef fat here at the market, although maybe we will, who knows, do you just cut it off a steak? What would you recommend a home cook do to source such an ingredient?
If I was at home personally cooking it for myself, maybe I would put it on the roof of my house for a day. Why not?
Okay, so that's what you would do. What I would do is I would go to a really good butcher and ask them if they could slice me off some dry aged beef fat.
And if you ask nicely, maybe they'll give it to you for free.
That was Sean Pham, chef owner of Simbal in Little Tokyo. We've been talking about a marinated meat dish made with cilantro root. I'm with Kong Tao of Tao Farms in Fresno, and he's the man who grows the cilantro roots that we were talking about with Sean. Hi.
Hi there.
So cilantro roots, who buys them here at the market?
Not very many people. Usually when people do buy them is when we leave them with the tops and we sell them as a bunch. But who buys them? Usually restaurants would order them. If I have some on display, people just kind of look at them and walk away. It's more of a conversation piece than anything.
Why do you choose to pull up the whole plant rather than just harvest the leaves?
Cilantro is one of those things that when it grows, you basically get one cut out of it. Unlike parsley, basil, things like that, we cut them and they grow back. So those we don't pull, but cilantro we do.
Does cilantro have a season?
It's year round. Right now it's very thin for us because it doesn't do as well just because it's been so hot. It's been 105 for like the past 2 or 3 weeks in Fresno. So.
And do you direct seed?
Yes, my mom is real big on saving seeds. She'll save the ones that are bolted with seeds. She'll dry them up and reuse them for the next grow.
Earlier, Sean and I were kind of just talking about how weird it is that different cultures eat tops of plants or bottoms of plants. So we were talking about roots. And I noticed that you have fresh peanuts. It's unusual to see here at the market.
Yeah, it's not very common, but there's a lot of cultures that really do eat it. It's just they can't get it. Peanuts is one of those things that only really big growers grow them because they dig them by machines. We just grow a very tiny amount. It's all hand-picked, hand-selected. So you don't see it very frequently because it's not simple to do.
So I have to ask, I know that my soil here in Los Angeles is like clay. It's like really, really tough. And peanuts grow under the ground. Do they have to have a looser soil?
We grow ours in a sandy type soil. It's harder to water because water drains so quickly from it. It doesn't retain water as well, but it does a lot better for the peanuts. It lets them expand, just like all the other roots we do, like sweet potatoes. We do it in a sandy type soil.
And are there different varieties or are peanuts just like peanuts?
I'm sure there's different varieties out there, just like anything. When we start them, we just buy generic peanuts that you would see in the grocery stores. And we start those, and then every year we save a certain percentage of what we grew that year, and so that way we can grow them the year after.
So it's just like potatoes, seed potatoes.
Yeah, we pretty much save the seed, and we were planting them generation after generation, yep.
So describe to me what they're like as we see them now in the market. They haven't been roasted, they haven't been boiled, they're fresh. So what is the nut inside like?
It's going to have a lot of moisture. When you bite into it, it's like eating a bean almost versus something that's dry and been sitting.
Yeah, it's almost like an edamame.
Yes, it's like edamame, but it's more fuller. You get more meat in it. And most people that buy them, they actually they boil them. And personally, I think peanuts taste better boiled than soybeans. So.
Yeah, I ran into some ladies here. I asked them how to cook them, and they said just boil them for 30 minutes in salted water.
Yes. I usually put spices like chilies, and then at the end of it, I add a beer, like a real good dark beer or something. Beer makes a difference.
Boiling peanuts in beer. Don't mind if I do. Find a recipe that makes use of cilantro roots on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we eat Norteño Mexican food on the banks of the LA River. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Hi, Jonathan. What are we eating today?
Tacos mostly, but also things that go into tacos and things that go underneath tacos.
Where?
Salazar, in the part of town sometimes known as Elysian Valley and at other times known as Frogtown.
People have been talking a lot about Salazar because it's a great outdoor place to eat.
Yeah, you'd think that there would be a million great outdoor places in L.A., and there aren't nearly as many as there should be. This sort of has the vibe of those places in Austin where they set up a taco cart and a dirt lot and have folding chairs about it. I mean, it's nicer than that. There are olive trees and it's landscaped and pebbles and there's a view over, you know, the beauty of Frogtown.
The concrete channel known as the Los Angeles River.
Right. Though it's one of the few parts that isn't quite as channelized as other parts. It's nice. You go outside, you sit at a table, people bring you excellent palomas, one of the great summer drinks, grapefruit and mezcal. And you eat whatever Estres Ochoa is pulling off his grill.
Now hold up, let me interrupt you, because we have some tape of Chef Ochoa manning the Santa Maria Grill at Salazar, talking to our very own Abby Fentress Swanson.
Ooh, I'm Ezra Ochoa, and I'm the chef here at Salazar. I'm from Mexicali, California, Mexico. What we're trying to show people, showcase, it's an experience. The Norteño, the Mexican Norteño experience, Northern Mexican cuisine. The style, not just the food, but the whole experience. It's a little piece of me, of who I am, the way I was raised, the way I grew up. Back home on the weekends, carne asada is king, and that's like a tradition. It's a religion to do carne asada every weekend. It's a gathering of families, of friends, of loved ones, and there's nothing better than to do it outdoors. It's the only way to do it back there. So we try to recreate that here. You know, you go to your uncle's farm, your friend, his cousin has a ranch, and everybody just brings a pollock. You know, somebody's in charge of the beans. My mom's in charge of the guacamole and the meat. And somebody brings the tortillas. So it's just a little bit way to get together as a family and just kind of like a true family meal. It's only like 3-4 elements that make a perfect taco. It's got to be a perfect tortilla, perfect cut of meat, cooked the right way, and in a good salsa. And that's all that makes, to me, a perfect taco. It's very noble. It's very clean, simple. But because it's so simple, you got to refine it perfectly. You got to refine the meat, how you grill it, make sure it's the right cut. We use all natural, humanely raised meat. For me, that's very important. You got to trim those ends on the chuck roll. Make sure you got the center, the nice fatty part with the nice marbling. Kick it over mesquite, and it's just heaven.
And where do you get your meat from?
Diamonds Ranch, Beeler's Farm for the pork. Outside of the meat and the Santa Maria Grill, the star of the show are the tortillas. Flour, it's king in the northern region of Mexico. We use it more than the corn. I've been trying to get the perfect tortilla for the last 2 years. I had it down before we opened the restaurant on a small batch. But, you know, you go on a bigger scale, and then you have, like, 10 people doing the tortilla. Something gets lost in the middle.
How many tortillas are you making a day?
Yeah, right now we're making, I would say, close to 1,000 tortillas on the weekends.
Ay, mama.
You're right. Tortilla heaven over here. The tortilleras that we're using here, the ladies, the wonderful, lovely ladies, they only done corn tortillas. They're not from where I'm from in Mexico, so it's very new to them. So right now my goal is to just make sure they're doing the exact same recipe I've been practicing with, the stuff that's been used in generations and generations back home in Sonora with my family down there, my mom in Mexicali. It's another form of pastries, I would say, those tortillas. There's a whole science to it. It's got to be a little bit stretchy, a little bit chewy. It's got to have some flavor, salt. A lot of people, when they do flour tortillas, they just do it plain. You got to have some flavor in the tortillas, like everything else. You got to season it right.
And everything, like the humidity, the temperature, the water, it all affects.
Exactly. Just like back in New York, the bagels. I mean, you're never going to have the same bagels or the same pizza because New York water is very different. The temperature there is different. Same thing with tortillas. You got to let it rest. You got to let it breathe. Humidity, like you said, the wind and the dirt outside of Salazar, you know? That's why the food tastes so much better in Mexico, because there's like dirt and you eat on the street, standing up. That whole experience of trying to do it here with the tortillas, with our meats. Obviously, on a healthy way, you know? We're not going to throw dirt on your tacos, per se, but...
Ochoa's other place, Tacos Mexicali, is known for its flour tortillas, which he brings in from Mexicali, his hometown, 3 times a week. Here, he's making flour tortillas. He originally started with a experiment I don't think he's really doing anymore, but he was using all kinds of exotic grist and toll wheats. And he was trying to do a really local tortilla. And some of the bran content of those flours make it really hard to make tortillas out of. But they had a really interesting taste and maybe a deficient texture. Now the texture's better and the taste isn't quite as wild wheat as it used to be. But it's still a really good flour tortilla.
What's bad about a good flour tortilla? Nothing.
Nothing at all.
Give us some of the combos that you enjoyed the most.
Those tortillas with grilled steak or chicken or pork or vegetables. You can order some guacamole to put on it, which is probably a good idea. They have a roasted chili salsa that's nice, and you drink and you eat tacos. The margaritas are good, palomas we've talked about. The micheladas, you know, the beer with different kinds of fruits and spices in it are nice.
And you're outside. What a California moment.
Yeah. They have a really nice version of esquites, which is something we start to see a lot in L.A. at the moment. Corn is grilled, scraped off the cob, and mixed with various creamy, spicy things. And you eat that or put it in tortilla. They have a few different kinds of beans, my favorite of which is pinto beans that are cooked in sort of a broth with chorizo. Maybe you'll get a bowl of the escabeche, which is, you know, pickled jalapenos and carrots. Again, this quite isn't all they have to it because they have a grill. And it's set up like one of those grills you might see in Santa Maria barbecues, a flat top. There's a big fire, mesquite fire, and a kind of rotary mechanism so you can move the grill up and down. And they cook pork chops and steaks and pescados arrandeado.
Describe what that is.
It's a Baja Sinaloa thing. Fish that's marinated in usually mayonnaise. It's not a highbrow dish. And then it's grilled over a slow fire until it caramelizes and gets super juicy. And it's delicious.
Oh, that sounds good.
They do a really nice, I guess, tres leches with a square of cornbread in the middle of it. So you crumble the cornbread into the milk, and it's nice. And the flan is very corny, very vegetably, and also a good savory dessert.
It's corn season now. I would expect corn to show up everywhere.
Especially there.
That's our favorite Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic, Jonathan Gold, talking up Salazar in Frogtown. See what Ochoa's perfect taco looks like. Yep, we're talking carne asada here on our website. And text the words good food to 69866, and you will get more weekly restaurant recommendations. A little perfect archive in your phone. In a minute, we go back in time to when Hollywood was rich with orchards and bean fields, and a herd of sheep was the thing that stopped traffic on Ventura Boulevard. Stay with us.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Until the 1950s, Los Angeles County was the agricultural center of North America. It's hard to believe, isn't it? Today, few Angelenos know that so many of the names we have trouble pronouncing, like La Cienega, Azusa de Duarte, and La Puente, are named after old ranchos. Rachel Searles and Judith Gerber are trying to bring back LA's farm roots in a new book called From Cows to Concrete: The Rise and Fall of Farming in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles was founded specifically to grow food because it was the second pueblo established in Alta California when it was part of New Spain. And the Spanish used it as a site to grow food that would help to shore up the new colony to feed the people at the presidios and at the missions. So that was what we were founded for. And it was all about growing grain. It was about growing wheat and barley and those kind of crops that can be stored for long periods of time.
And cattle.
And cattle. The missionaries learned that they could raise cattle and use the hides to trade. They were called California banknotes for many years.
So what were some of the more unlikely cash crops that were grown?
Well, I think one of the first that certainly surprised us was hemp. The Spanish colonial government wanted the colonists in the Los Angeles area to have something that they could grow and sell beyond those cattle hides that we were mentioning and the grain. So they sought to get farmers to grow hemp, which was used to make high-quality rope for the riggings of ships.
Was the issue of drought as critical to the farming industry back then as it is today?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the reasons that cattle didn't continue their reign was because of a severe drought in the 1860s that pretty much resulted in thousands and thousands of cattle just dropping dead. Los Angeles was known as the queen of the cow counties, and they pretty much lost, you know, most of their fortune, anything they had amassed, because the cattle just couldn't withstand the drought.
As we come into the time where Los Angeles becomes the absolute powerhouse, which was the beginning of the 20th century through the Second World War.
Yes.
When I think of that period of time, I think about a period of time of all of these people immigrating to help with the farmland, much like the story today.
Yes, that is definitely a through line in the story of agriculture in Los Angeles and in California as well. The Native American people who were here first were the first farm laborers. And then we had Chinese laborers who came when they finished building the Transcontinental Railroad, followed by Japanese farm workers, Filipino farm workers, Mexican farm workers, and many, many others.
So let's talk about the Japanese farm workers and World War II. There was a tremendous amount of dislocation.
Exactly. I mean, during the course of their being sent off to relocation camps, or some people say now incarcerated, which basically, you know, a lot of the Japanese and the Japanese American children that were born here were not permitted to own land, and they were leasing land. And so they had really nothing to come back to once they were sent away during World War II. Anything that they had was often sold off. And there were a few cases where there were people that were looking out for their interests, but for the most part, that really went away once World War II came and they were no longer able to recreate all the things that it needed to become a business again.
So can you paint a picture of what Los Angeles looked like when it was this thriving farm county? What did certain landscapes that we're so familiar with now that are completely densely urbanized, what would they have looked like back then?
Well, I live in the San Gabriel Valley, so I really love to drive along the 210 freeway and look up at the mountains and imagine what it looked like then based on what I've read. And apparently, there was a citrus belt that went up into the low foothills. So as you went along those San Gabriel Mountains from Pasadena towards San Bernardino, you would see sort of a belt of lemons and orange trees covering that mountainside into the low foothills. And you would also see orchards of walnuts, which were another huge crop.
Venice was known as the celery capital of the world. And there were a lot of strawberry farms that you could see even at Torrance Airport up until the early 1960s. And even here in the west side of LA, we had crops, vegetable fields, everything from strawberries to leafy greens to the celery.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the early days of California farming, did it start in the 30s, the wine movement, or did it start even earlier?
The wine movement started even earlier. It started in the late 1800s. The missions, you know, came here, and the first wine, mother vine, was at Mission San Gabriel. It still actually exists. And so from there, people that came here to sort of try and make a living, and they tried many things, they started planting vineyards in downtown Los Angeles. Los Angeles County was actually the first commercial wine county in California because it traveled up through the missions. It made sense. And then pretty soon we had different people from different parts of Europe coming, the French and the Italians, who weren't really satisfied with the quality of the mission grapes because many of them were not so happy with the lack of flavor. And so they brought other types of grapes, and that's where commercial wine industry actually started much earlier than in the 1930s.
In the Chinatown area, we still have that street, which we call Vignes, right?
Right. So Jean-Louis Vignes, he was one of the French vintners that I was mentioning who wanted to bring something. I mean, Alvera Street was known as Vine Street for wine, and lots of the streets in downtown Los Angeles are actually named after early vintners.
Fascinating. Who were some of the characters? Because there must have been a lot of characters.
There were a lot. One that is a particular favorite of mine was Eliza Tibbetts from Riverside. She planted the first navel oranges, which transformed the orange industry in Southern California, basically. Her trade was she was a medium. She communicated with dead people. And that's how she met her husband, Luther, because she was trying to communicate with his deceased wife. So Luther and Eliza came by way of Washington, D.C. to the new colony of Riverside. They had no farming experience, so they thought, we'll just figure something out. We'll make our fortune as farmers. And they contacted an acquaintance at the USDA, the the new U.S. Department of Agriculture, who shipped two naval orange trees, which were from Brazil, to Eliza. Eliza and Luther rode 60 miles in their buckboard wagon from Riverside to Los Angeles to pick up these two trees. Eliza planted them in her yard and watered them with her dishwater, and they grew to be these trees that had this sweet fruit that was so easy to peel, in stark contrast to the other sort of bitter, sour, seedy oranges before that. And ironically, Eliza and Luther died penniless while others became millionaires from growing this particular orange.
Now, who's your favorite character,
Judy? Well, it's interesting. We both have females as our favorite characters. Mine is Harriet Russell Strong, also known as the Walnut Queen. Harriet Strong was another woman who didn't have the best of fortune. Her husband tragically killed himself, and Harriet had a lot of issues physically with her back and was pretty much confined to her sickbed for a long time, but she had to figure out a way to survive for her and her children. One of the popular trends during the turn of the 20th century were women's hats and feathers. So she had some pompous grass, which she wanted to grow to decorate the women's hats. But she also figured she needed a way to make a living long term. So she became the Walnut Queen in Whittier, and she planted these vast acres of walnut trees, and her pompous grass is what supported her. She made a fortune, but she also had the same issue when we talked about the drought being a problem and water. That was an issue. So she came up with several innovative ideas. She was able to get some patents and able to advocate for a lot of things. And she always said that if she had been an Eastern man, some of the male farmers wouldn't have been so helpful. But she was also very active in the suffragette movement and stood on the stage with people like Susan B. Anthony. And, you know, she managed to really rally around and actually become quite successful.
So I want you to tell me the story about this giant sycamore tree, not the tree that grows in Brooklyn, but the tree that grows in Compton.
That's funny, because at one point we were talking about titling that chapter A Tree Grows in Compton, because we do really build the book around this tree called the Eagle Tree in Compton, and it's at the corner of Short Avenue and Poppy Avenue, and it's at the end of a long driveway. It's a giant, beautiful old sycamore, and there is a fence around it that has a plaque. You have to go up to the door of the neighbor who lives there and ask if you can take a look at it, and they say people come by occasionally to look at it. But the significance of the Eagle Tree is that it was the boundary marker for the Rancho San Pedro, which is one of the original ranchos of Los Angeles. So it marked a place where thousands of cattle roamed, where there were orchards and there was hay and there was corn and there was this bountiful agriculture. And now it's a food desert community. So we really thought that that tree was sort of emblematic of the radical change that happened in Los Angeles.
What ultimately led to the demise of farming in L.A.?
Well, I think there were several factors, but the nail in the coffin, so to speak, of farming was really World War II. Because all of the things that I mentioned that they discovered, once people came to Los Angeles and the aerospace and those industries took over, the international airport was here, it became a prime location, and the land was flat and you could build houses on it, and developers started gobbling up the land until there was pretty much nothing left to do but to market what it was.
I have to say that I find this particular history very poignant in light of today's food insecurity, aka hunger, given that so much of LA was once rich farmland. Did you find in doing the research for this book, combined with the work that you do in food justice, that you have a hope for a different type of resurgence?
Yes. I sort of had two emotions while I was writing the book. And one was, wow, this is sad that we've lost so much, that now everyone is so excited about local, fresh food, and yet we've paved over so much of our farmland that we used to have this amazing farmland, and now it's under pavement. There are food deserts on top of what was once abundant farmland. At the same time, I did feel a sense of hope because we chronicle the rise of the urban farming movement, which has been so prevalent since about 2008. And it's exciting to see the resurgence of backyard gardening, the growth of community gardens and farmers markets. people are beginning to really treasure some of the things that we've lost so much of, but I do think there's hope to bring some of that back.
Rachel Searles and Judith Gerber are the authors of From Cows to Concrete: The Rise and Fall of Farming in Los Angeles. Last week, we aired the first part of a groundbreaking series from KCRW's investigative reporter, Karen Fauché. Her report is called Burned: Abuse in LA's Restaurant Industry. As promised, here's the next installment that deals with restaurant workers injured on the job.
I'm talking with a group of former dishwashers and cooks in a driveway in Azusa. They're filling out legal forms trying to recover back pay they claim was stolen by their employers. And that's when one of them motions me over to look at something on his phone. It's a photo gallery of sliced fingers and a nearly severed thumb. When was this?
I've been cut many times. Around here you can see how deep the knife went.
Armando Santiago was a cook at Grand Burger in Glendora. When he cut himself, he couldn't stop for stitches. He usually just wrapped his bloody hands in a cloth and went on cooking. He says the one time the owner took him to the doctor, he had to change out of his uniform.
He takes off my T-shirt with the restaurant logo, and he gives me another T-shirt so I can go like that.
Then, three other workers show me photos of their injuries. After that, two women approach me and say they got repeated urinary tract infections because they were rarely allowed to go to the bathroom.
They would get mad at us every time we asked to use the bathroom. They'd say, again? You need to go again?
Go too many times, the other worker says, and the boss might fire you.
One day he asked me where she was, and I said she just left to the bathroom. He told me, she needs to be well. If not, she can leave.
Rosa, who was already in trouble for going to the bathroom too often, spilled hot oil on her chest and hands.
Sola al doctor al hospital.
I went on my own to the emergency room at the hospital. I didn't work for like 15 days, and the owner was upset because I'd gone to the doctor.
And it seems everyone here has a similar story. One man shows me his burns. Two others lift pant legs to reveal bulging varicose veins. And of course, a multitude of knee injuries and bad backs. Worn out bodies, all in the service of good food. And then they open their wallets. Each has their own collection of medical appointment cards from local clinics. One is in a nearby strip mall.
Santa Adelina Medical Clinic.
The clinic is run by Jorge Velasquez, who's a physician's assistant. There isn't a medical doctor on staff, and 80% of his patients are low-wage workers.
The majority of the work-related injuries that I see are restaurant-based, and burns, lacerations, falls, back injuries.
It's cash only here at Santa Adelina, which is a selling point to some employers.
A lot of times their bosses or the owners don't have workers' comp insurance. They don't pay into it, so they do it under the table.
The abuse, Velasquez says, is rampant.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, they're mom-and-pop restaurants that are privately owned, and there's actually chains.
But chances are, you're not going to hear about it. Most of the restaurant workers Velasquez treats are undocumented. Fear of deportation or being fired keeps them silent when injuries force them off the job or they're denied pay.
They don't have many rights, and they know it. So they'll put up with it as much as they can.
There is a government agency that's supposed to watch out for those workers. It's called Cal OSHA, and it's completely overwhelmed. It has about one field inspector for every 100,000 workers.
How much can you do with 300, 400 employees statewide to protect the lives of millions of workers? I mean, the math doesn't add up.
Veteran labor investigator Carlos Boker says most of the workers he meets don't even know what Cal OSHA is.
You ask about Cal OSHA and they look at me like, what the hell is that? And the consumer just goes there, gets a good meal, and they like the food, but they never wonder what's going on behind the kitchen.
Even if the customers were curious, they might have a hard time finding out who's getting hurt behind the counter.
Then there's the retaliation that many workers face when they speak up about injuries, stolen paychecks, and being denied workers' comp. Again, KCRW investigative reporter Karen Fauché.
You're listening to a secretly recorded shakedown. Two men, one with a local gang's tattoo on his head, are confronting Rafael Rosales at his L.A. doorstep. The men are telling Rafael that the next time they visit, it may not be so nice, and it's caught on a cell phone by Rafael's nephew. But here's the surprise. These guys aren't collecting on a debt. They're threatening Rafael because he is. He's a restaurant worker who's suing to get his back pay.
My client got very scared, naturally, and began to ask, why are you here? And they said, well, we're here because the restaurant wants to settle the case. We're being friendly today, but the next time that we come, we won't be so friendly.
Attorney Sebastian Sanchez with Bet Zedek Legal Services represents Rosales and two other former cooks at Carousel, a popular Middle Eastern restaurant in Glendale and a favorite of the Kardashians.
They were never paid any overtime whenever they worked over 8 hours a day or over 40 hours a week. Never given the rest periods they were required, never given the meal periods that they were required. So we filed a lawsuit in Superior Court on their behalf.
After the lawsuit was filed, the suspected gang members showed up trying to convince Rosales to reconsider.
It was an act of retaliation, a direct threat of violence by this employer because our workers had decided to file a lawsuit.
Carousel's owner, Mike Chalakian, has not returned repeated calls for comment on this story.
What did the owner of Carousel say about all this?
He has no idea how this happened. He went on record and filed in court a statement saying that he never met these men, that he had no idea why these men approached our clients to offer settlement for this lawsuit.
The scare tactics almost worked.
After this incident, our client was just an emotional mess, and understandably so. This was a frightening, horrible experience. And he had no idea what to do. He didn't know whether or not he wanted to continue.
But he and his co-workers chose to keep going and recently settled with Carousel. The terms are confidential. The video is rare evidence of what Sanchez says is common in the restaurant industry.
Generally, retaliation takes place in darkness, whether they meet up outside the restaurant or outside the workplace and makes a threat, whether they slash a client's tires, break into their car. These things happen very frequently.
Sometimes it's not gang members who come to the door. It's a process server.
They were doing these pretty extreme things like suing workers and putting restraining orders on people. And ultimately, like, their intention was to put fear into the worker and also trying to split us up and trying to make us tired.
Kuma Kato is talking about his old bosses at Fuga Bar. It's a popular sushi restaurant in Little Tokyo. Kato was a waiter there when in 2014, he and his co-workers filed claims for stolen tips and unpaid overtime, totaling $190,000. The owners sued the workers, claiming defamation.
I think they're trying to hide everything that we were telling them was wrong with how they're running their business, stealing tips, telling people to clock out before their work was done, and then having them work more. They didn't want that to be known by the public, for sure.
The owners dropped the defamation lawsuit and the workers settled. A manager at Fuga had no comment on this story. But Kato, who's worked in restaurants for over 11 years, says the retaliation is nothing new and the message is clear.
They could replace us. That's the idea, is that the worker is very replaceable, especially in the restaurant industry.
Now, not every restaurant is cheating workers and threatening them, but a lot are, says veteran state labor investigator Carlos Boker.
There's also a lot of threats and intimidation for people that file claims. And there's some companies that have established a way of blacklisting people for employment purposes.
The employer seeks not only to rid themselves of a worker who has complained or who they view as a troublemaker, but they also intend to send a message to the workers who stay, that this is what will happen to you if you disobey, if you speak out.
Julie Hsu is California's labor commissioner. She says retaliation and threats keep workers silent about their exploitation.
So it's really important that we get ahead of that problem. And we have the power to restore workers to their jobs, to demand back pay be paid.
But the system is on overload.
Retaliation complaints have gone up in the last 5 years. The complexity of the cases have also increased. Each complaint involves more violations.
There were 3,800 complaints of retaliation filed in 2014 and only three attorneys to handle them. And then there's the backlog of cases they didn't get to in the years before. To make matters worse, by federal law, every complaint is supposed to be closed within 90 days, something that has literally never happened, says Sue.
It takes a little over 300 days to investigate a retaliation case.
A lot can happen in that 300 days.
We had an investigation against a buffet in Northern California where as soon as we began the investigation, the employer put the workers onto a bus and ship them out of the area, and we couldn't find them, and therefore obviously couldn't file a retaliation complaint. And so we see those kinds of actions.
Sue's office has managed to shorten the waiting times, and she's created a fast-track system to let sensitive cases jump to the front of the line. She's also required some restaurants to post a public notice, a sort of scarlet letter, admitting they've retaliated against their workers. But sometimes they just ignore the order. And then there are the confidentiality agreements. Nearly every attorney I spoke with told me restaurant owners require them when cases are settled.
Everything's a secret, and it works perfectly for employers. They can break the law, pay a little bit of money, and get away with it, and they can go on with their lives as if nothing happened.
So it really enforces a code of silence in the industry and enforces this veil of fear.
Kathy Huang is the director of Restaurant Opportunity Center in Los Angeles, a workers' advocacy group. She thinks confidentiality agreements literally and legally muzzle workers.
In what we see in the restaurant industry, workers don't really know about other workers filing claims and winning them. Ultimately, that's a direct result of workers being forced into these confidentiality agreements where they can never talk about what they actually want.
Customers are also left in the dark with no idea what's happening to the people who make their meals.
The public doesn't find out. The public doesn't learn that this is so common.
Workers are not getting educated. The employers suppress their rights to ask questions. And the consumer just goes there, gets a good meal, and they like the food, but they never wonder what's going on behind the kitchen.
Not all of the 3,800 retaliation complaints involve a restaurant. And with 68,000 restaurants statewide, some argue this proves that only a tiny fraction abuse their workers. But Sanchez says don't be fooled by the numbers.
It's incredibly frequent. I would feel comfortable saying that in a majority of cases, there is some sort of retaliatory behavior by an employer. So my assumption when I go dine is something bad is happening here, and it's just a matter of time before one of these workers comes to my office.
A few weeks later, Sanchez and his team had a legal clinic for workers. And not surprisingly, some were from local restaurants. For KCRW, I'm Karen Fauchet.
We'll hear the last part of KCRW's Burned, Abuse in LA's Restaurant Industry series on next week's show. Tune in. Now we move out of the restaurant and into the field. A new documentary called Unbroken Ground follows farmers, ranchers, and fishermen trying to strike a balance between breaking even and preserving the land. In Santa Barbara, KCRW's Larry Perel sat down with the man behind the film, Chris Malloy.
In a lot of ways, this is a story we've heard before, commercial farming destroying our land. How do the characters in your film offer a new or different approach?
Yeah, this is about a deeper analysis of what's really happening. It's really easy to demonize the agricultural families out there that are doing what they're doing. I really wanted this film to not, it's pro-grazing, pro-farming, pro-fishing. The folks in this film are seeing decades ahead, 100 years ahead. Wes Jackson says, if you're dreaming about doing something that you can do in your lifetime, you're not dreaming big enough. Most of the folks in this film are a little bit crazy. They're unapologetic and not afraid to fail.
So let's talk about restorative grazing for a minute. What are your thoughts on that?
The O'Briens in South Dakota.
These are the O'Briens that are in the film.
Yes, and they had raised cattle for, decades, and they were having trouble getting by. And when you're out there by yourself in South Dakota for a winter, you had time to think. And they thought about what was there originally. And the bison had been on those prairies for thousands and thousands of years, and so they got made fun of by other ranchers, but they went for it, and they did it, and they've shown that there's a viable market for bison, and the pastures are looking really great. And I really want to reiterate that, I'm absolutely pro-grazing. I run some cattle myself, and I think that, if we look at the Santa Barbara County, we owe so much to cattle ranches keeping places wide open, and they've had a tough time with folks, getting after them because they felt that the cattle were not good. But now that we've got our wineries and all those corridors are locked up, with fences and vines, the people are starting to wish that their ranchers were back, mm-hmm. And, I know some characters that are in their 90s that have been running cattle in these hills, and they can tell you, they didn't learn it from a book. They didn't learn it, go to college to tell you what the pastures are doing, what the rain's doing, what the biomass is, and they might use a different vernacular. But the knowledge in the folks that have been in the cattle business in this region have, I think we all owe them some gratitude.
If the process of restorative grazing is working with bison, in South Dakota. Why aren't more people doing it?
That's a good question. That's a good question. And I think there actually are more folks raising bison than you'd think. I think that when, you know, ag is always a precarious place financially. And if people see something that's already working, you're going to do it. Because if it doesn't, you're probably losing your home. Mm-hmm. It takes somebody with the conviction and maybe a little craziness to say, I'm going to start a new way of producing this product and hope that the world buys in. I mean, that takes a lot of guts, you know. And the O'Briens, if you see them in the film, you can tell they got a lot of guts. They got heart.
You know, early on in the film, I believe it's Dr. Wes Jackson with the Land Institute says, we characterize land differently and we shouldn't.
Right.
Let's have a listen to that.
Well, we seem to feel free to regard wilderness as sacred and agricultural land as profane. And that is a disconnect.
A disconnect, why?
Well, that's one of my favorite lines in the film, because what we have is this notion that, like, ag land is sort of being ruined and it's everything that's happening on it is probably bad. And then we have our parks where you pay your fee and then you run around in the park and you feel good about, you know, your communion with nature. And then, but what Wes is saying, he's 80 and he's been farming his whole life, is that if you treat your farm fields and if you treat your wide open spaces with the same mindset, they're not as different in the way we use them as people perceive.
Find a link to the trailer for Unbroken Ground on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We close out the show with a tale of vegan mayonnaise, money, and the American Egg Board. You're not going to want to miss it. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Much has been written about Hampton Creek, the company that produces an eggless product called Just Mayo. But you know who's not buying it? The American Egg Board. It seems they quietly slipped money to Unilever, owner of Hellmann's and Best Foods Mayonnaise, to fund a lawsuit requiring Hampton Creek to change its name. The backstory, well, it's more sinister, says Ted Genoways, contributing editor for The New Republic. So what was Unilever's argument for wanting Just Mayo to change the name of their product?
Well, in some ways, it's as silly as you can imagine. I mean, the argument was simply that the definition that the Food and Drug Administration uses for mayonnaise contains the words egg yolk containing. And they argued that if the mayonnaise that Just Mayo was making is a vegan mayonnaise and therefore doesn't contain egg yolks, that it's not really mayonnaise and that it should have to carry a label that describes it as salad dressing or some other category.
That seems like a reasonable reason that one giant corporation would sue a much smaller food company, but it comes down to the money. So let's talk about the relationship between these industry boards like the American Egg Board and the USDA. How much money does the government pay these boards to promote their products? And in return for that money, are there rules that they must abide by?
Right. Yeah. So essentially, each of these food commodities are assigned their own promotion board. And the idea is that the board is supposed to promote that particular commodity. Originally, the idea was that it would be done internationally, but now it's also done domestically. And altogether, they receive about $1 billion in funding. $200 million or so of that comes directly from Congress and is still used internationally. The rest of it is coming from what are called checkoff dollars. And those are really the funds that are the subject of so much controversy, because they are, according to the boards themselves, not technically tax dollars, but they are compelled payments that come as a percentage of sales and go through the government to these boards. And of course, as you can imagine, small producers say, if the government is compelling me to pay a percentage of my income, that's a tax. And the question then is, if these things are government funded, if they're government dollars, shouldn't they be subject to the same oversight that other government agencies are?
So what happened in this instance is what? The money was from where and who did it go to?
Right, yeah. So in this particular case, the money at issue is funding the American Egg Board. And so the Egg Board is under the USDA for government purposes. And the Egg Board, of course, is supposed to be promoting the sales of eggs. But in this case, they saw it as their mission not only to promote egg sales, but to essentially try to sabotage the sales of a product like Just Mayo, using the justification that eggless products are a threat to egg sales. And the communication that was found through a FOIA request was really surprising. I mean, it was not just talking about ways of trying to promote eggs and ways of trying to compete against this other product, but really extreme measures such as trying to convince Whole Foods not to carry the product, and even joking among members of the Egg Board that, you know, it would be easiest to just, you know, have the CEO of Hampton Creek to call in a mafia hit against the CEO.
The importance of the Freedom of Information Act and one zealous researcher really is at the heart of this story, right?
Absolutely. So there's a guy named Ryan Noah Shapiro, who I think has been aptly described as a FOIA ninja, who basically has spent years making FOIA requests for various parts of the government in order to, in particular, see the ways in which the government is influenced by corporate dollars. And this particular request, looking at the Egg Board, was one part of a larger request looking at this sort of influence, because there's been such ongoing complaint from farmers who say, we don't feel like we should be compelled to pay to these commodity boards if the boards are lobbying for policies that we don't agree with.
Does this also go towards the larger concern of ag-gag laws and the idea of transparency, and that if we didn't have access to this Freedom of Information Act, that, for example, in this case, we wouldn't know about the subterfuge that was funding this lawsuit?
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think is ultimately most concerning here. A number of the commodity boards petitioned the House Agricultural Committee to make them exempt from FOIA oversight. And essentially, having been caught doing something that was a misuse of government funds and was potentially illegal, they've asked for an exemption from scrutiny. And that's exactly what the ag-gag laws are doing. And this is certainly part of that same strategy, that rather than improving industry practices and improving transparency, the response to these investigations and to this sort of revelations that have been brought about by FOIA requests in this case has instead been to try to obscure the truth and to make it as hard for people to know, you know, what's going on behind closed doors as possible.
So Unilever eventually dropped this suit, but as you say, they, along with many other manufacturers, approached Congress to prevent the information about how they're using funds to reach the public. And yet often they want to use the shield of the government to shield them from things. It seems like they're trying to operate sort of both sides against the middle.
That's right. I mean, the thing that's really almost absurd to me in this case is that for years, the argument of the small farmer was that these checkoff programs, these commodity boards, shouldn't be able to collect dollars from them. And essentially, the argument was, out of those boards, that they should be able to collect those dollars because what they were engaging in was government speech. that was always the language of it, and saying that, in effect, being under the USDA and producing a message that was government approved, that they were a government agency. But when it comes to oversight and the sort of transparency that FOIA laws require, they now want to say that they're not part of the government, that they're independent, that they're not government workers, and that they should be allowed those monies, but not the transparency that comes with getting public dollars.
I'm just curious about this sort of larger issue of these boards existing at all, given the huge rise in power and wealth of most of these commodity-based companies. I mean, initially these were created to sort of help the little guy, but now, as you say, they've become almost de facto lobbying organizations. It seems that all the money involved could be put to such better use. Has there been any movement at all to sort of sever the relationship between the government and these marketing organizations?
Yes, this is something that small producers have been concerned about for years. It's something that the National Farmers Union has been working on for years. But it seems that no matter how much complaint there is out of the little guy, that this is really being presented as something that helps them market and grow their business. No matter how much complaint there is that that's not true, the boards just continue growing and getting more powerful.
Going back to the issues of secrecy and transparency, is this year's agricultural appropriations bill going to be taking on this issue?
Well, the bill has language that would exempt these boards from FOIA laws. What's been interesting is that since I published my article, there's been pushback, particularly from the National Pork Producers Council, arguing that they were not seeking a blanket FOIA exemption, but a limited FOIA exemption. All I can tell you is that is not the language that's in the letter that they sent to the Appropriations Committee, and it's not the language that's in the bill.
The Freedom of Information Act continues to be everything for those of us who want to know what's happening. And if people want to allow it to continue unfettered, they have to once again wade through an agricultural appropriations bill?
Yes. If this particular provision is included ultimately, and the USDA then agrees that these boards are not subject to FOIA, what that will mean is that there's no way to know how these semi-governmental bodies, or perhaps wholly governmental bodies, are interacting with private industry. And obviously, it's in the interest of consumers and small producers alike to know how their government is being influenced in all sorts of regulatory matters by the industry that they're supposed to be regulating.
Learn more about what Ted found and hear an interview I did with him about his book, The Chain: Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And while you're there, for something a little more upbeat, listen to the first episode of our 2016 PieCast. It's a podcast about pie. A PieCast. Get it? We take you on a delicious journey in three parts to meet pie lovers, pie eaters, and expert pie makers all across the country. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team, and boy, there is a whole bunch of them.
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say,
Pete Bloomberg,
Joel Stein,
Jackie Liu,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.